Today's subject is Human Genetics in the 21st Century, the HGI Project. So really the focus for the entire week will be what's called the HGI Project, and that's what we'll be talking about a little bit today. I'd like to introduce the project to you and walk through some of the philosophy behind the project. And as we go along, I would hope that if you have a question, that you would raise it as you have it, or if you have a comment about something that I say, if you'd like to raise it before the group, please feel free to interject as we move along. The other thing I guess I'd like you to be thinking about through the week as we think about this topic is, on the last day, we'd like to talk about the role of the church in all of this, in this enterprise of human genetics. So you might be thinking about that as we move through the subject. Without a doubt, we live in a highly scientific, technological world. I don't think we need to think too hard to realize that, even up here in Holden. And certainly with that has come many benefits. We've seen that life operates pretty easily because of science and technology, but we've also seen some real tragedies when it comes to the uses of science and technology. I'm not sure I need to list them for you all. It seems like the Holden crowd is fairly enlightened, but we could talk about the atom bomb, we could talk about Bhopal, India, we could talk about Love Canal, we could talk about lots of things in terms of the downside of science and technology. And it seems as if genetics has the potential for offering us both this joy and this danger on the other side. So genetics is really a good subject to focus our thoughts about science and technology around. Because of this ambiguity with science and technology, I think we often feel very powerless as citizens to confront, to ask questions, to become part of the shaping of the uses of these technologies. And so really my goal today is to offer you at least two tools that I think we can use as people to engage in this dialogue with this enterprise, because certainly we don't want to see that genetics ends up to be misused in the ways we've seen other science and technology. Just to give you an idea about the power of genetics, at least to some people, I have a few quotes here. Let's see, they're always so good. Let's see. In talking about discovering information about genetics, David Baltimore, who's a Nobel laureate, is recently involved in a scandal about ethics in science, writes, "The notion that there are things too dangerous to know is fundamentally anti-science and anti-progress," says Baltimore. "It's not a good representation of what the human spirit wants." And I think the power of that statement puts us in a position where, how can we respond to this? Because right away he's saying to us, we can't ask questions about whether this is good knowledge to pursue or not. That he's saying the human spirit wants this, and we're anti-science and anti-progress if we raise even a single question about this. So that is kind of this powerful attitude that I think we need to figure out ways in which to respond to, just for example. So one of the tools that I would like to offer you in thinking about genetics is that we need to remember that genetics is part of the scientific enterprise, and that enterprise is in society. I think too often science wants to put itself outside society and be outside this way, so that science is up here and the rest of us is down here. So I think the very first tool that we can all use is remember that science is situated in culture. Excellent example of this comes with the HGI project, which I'll be talking about the details of in a moment. You may have heard, how many of you have heard of the HGI project? A couple of you? In the last couple of years, there's been a real push to get the public's attention concerning this project. So I've even seen clips on Good Morning America and the Today Show and things like that. But it turns out that the former director of this project was James Watson, who was a very famous scientist who won a Nobel Prize for his and Crick's pursuit of the determination for the structure of DNA. But anyway, he's a very charismatic, I guess, or he has a very powerful personality. But he recently had to resign from the position of directorship because he was holding stock in biotechnology companies. And this project has the potential to influence the biotechnology industry. So right there, that reminds us that even though we've got this science, there's also a business end connected to this science. And I think too often we forget that there's this business end. And in fact, Princeton University physicist Freeman Dyson says, that predicts that biotechnology will change the world more profoundly than did the Industrial Revolution. In the last year, the biotechnology industry was a billion-dollar business. So I think as we talk about human genetics, as we talk about the science and the scientists, we can't forget that there's this business connected to science, right? And so on. So we need to remember that science is situated in culture, that there's this web of human activity surrounding it. And I think we'll be exploring this as we look at this subject. The other tool that I would like to offer, particularly a tool to respond to this notion that science is about the pursuit of truth, and how can you argue with that? Which is a very powerful argument to us. I'd like to offer you another tool, and it's one that we looked at quite a lot last week, and that is, we need to remember that science is constructed by human beings, all right? That knowledge in science is built by human beings. And so to say that this pursuit of truth is absolutely value-free and it's the highest pursuit that one should work at, I think, is not recognizing the fact that we human beings are the ones who are constructing these knowledge systems. Another way to say this more simply is that I really think that if you can take a scientific theory and you can look at it like you look at a painting. A painting tells you something about the culture of the person doing the painting. All right? Likewise, I think we'll see today that you can take a scientific theory and if you look very carefully, you can find out about the culture that the people who are developing the theory come out of. And I think if we keep this in mind, we have something to argue against when someone says, this is a pursuit of the highest truth, of the highest value. Keeping this in mind, I think, really gives us a way to start dialogue. So we'll see those two themes today, that science is a web of human activity, that knowledge is constructed by human beings. So let me tell you now a little bit about this project here, and we'll flesh out these two themes. The federal government now is supporting a scientific research project, a big biology project, called the Human Genome Initiative, or HGI. Right away, just making that statement, the federal government is supporting this project, again reminds us that science can't operate without your tax dollars, right? So you have a direct connection to all of this. They're supporting this project, it's supposed to be a 15-year project, to the tune of $3 billion, which, I mean, in the grand scheme of trillions, it's not that big, but still, this is $3 billion that the federal government has decided to slot towards this project. Let me just tell you simply what the project seeks to do, and then I'll explain it a little bit. The project seeks to, let's call, sequence the human DNA. All right, so what we need to do now is spend some time to figure out what this means. What does it mean to sequence the human DNA? I should say a little bit about the rationale just to get started so you know why people would even try to understand what's going on here. Superficially, the rationale is that once you sequence this human DNA, you'll be able to do gene therapy. You'll be able to cure genetic disorders. That's kind of one level of rationale. Further down, the rationale is things like we can cure alcoholism, we can cure Alzheimer's, we can cure cancer. We can even solve the problem of homelessness. Right, that's been some rationale for doing this project.
That's been stated.
Daniel Koshlin, editor of Science Magazine, has said in print that it has the potential for solving a homeless problem. Now, his rationale is, of course, all homeless people have genetically related mental disorders. It's kind of his rationale, right? So that if you could replace their gene, then they would no longer be homeless, right? So this is, I mean, right there, we could probably spend the whole hour talking about that rationale alone. So I just point out some of this rationale so that we can get started. All right, so that's why we want to care about what it means to sequence the human DNA.
Is that also to program a certain type of human being born?
Well, no one wants to say anything like that. But certainly, I think it has the potential for providing that kind of
That would come out of it.
This project, definitely.
Scientific.
Definitely. So let me now try to help you see for a moment something of what this means so that you can understand what the project is seeking to do. And the way we start maybe is to focus on the word DNA over there. As you may or may not realize, DNA is considered to be a molecule, and molecules are the central paradigm for biochemistry and molecular biology, which are the two disciplines that now are working on this project. And what that essentially means is, according to people working in this field, that when they put on the perspective of their work, that is, when you put on the perspective of a biochemist, or when you put on the perspective of a molecular biologist, you look out into the world and you see that every living thing is composed of atoms and molecules, according to this theory. So we look here at these lovely flowers and we can see those atoms and molecules. I, as a biochemist, can see some proteins, I can see some DNA, I can see some carbohydrates and what have you. That also means that you, to a biochemist, is really nothing more than a collection of atoms and molecules. Now, on the one hand, we're reducing humanity to atoms and molecules. But on the other hand, it's truly a wonder that if you look at this theory and you talk about these individual atoms and molecules, somehow they all get together and you create cell parts, you create cells, you create organs, you create tissues, and you create you. So really, I'm sitting here talking to you from a biochemical point of view as these collections of atoms and molecules that are giving me function, that allow me to talk and to think and to breathe at the same time that I'm talking. So on the one hand, it's very reductionistic. We're reducing humans to atoms and molecules. But on the other hand, as you look at the theory, it's really quite amazing that you can explain how human beings function by atoms and molecules. So there's this kind of, again, we've got these kind of two different sides. But in saying that human beings are composed of atoms and molecules, I'd like to remind you that this is really an abstract notion. And it's abstract on two levels. First of all, can you see those atoms and molecules? You can't. You literally cannot see these atoms and molecules as we sit here. So that's one way in which atoms and molecules are abstract. But I think there's another way in which atoms and molecules are abstract, and that is abstract. Some people would argue that atoms and molecules are nothing more than a useful construct for explaining how systems work. So you talk about, for example, characteristics of atoms. You talk about how big an atom is. Well, that's just a useful system that we have. It may turn out that as we evolve with our theories, that atoms don't really exist. All right, it's just a useful construct. So I think we need to keep that point in mind, that at some level, something about it is very abstract. It's artificial. We use it because it helps explain things. And I think too often these days, atoms and molecules are presented as real concrete things. You look in textbooks, for example, and no one ever says atoms and molecules are models for how things work. They say atoms and they talk about atoms and molecules as real things. And I think we need to keep that in mind as we talk about this whole system, because it's really quite amazing that this abstract system can explain us. But anyway, why don't you take a moment to just encounter each other as atoms and molecules? How would you respond to each other if you're only using this scientific perspective of atoms and molecules? How does that change your interaction with one another? Why don't you try it out with each other?
Can you try it out?
No idea.
We would be attracted or repelled.
You would be attracted or repelled. You'd want to bond. You might ask how your carbon's doing today. How's your phosphorus? Right? So it really gives kind of a different spin on things, but I think it's useful to think about, because I don't know about your experience with medical science, for example. Very often I feel as if I'm just a collection of atoms and molecules to my physician, for example. All right? So it does help you give some understanding to the relationship of scientists and maybe physicians to their subjects, objects of study, whatever. All right, so given that it's an abstract system, given that it reduces us to atoms and molecules, let's just take a minute to think about our atoms and molecules. Some of you may remember that if we took out all your molecules, we could sort them, just like I sorted garbage today, we could sort them into four categories. All right. So there are the proteins, the carbohydrates, the lipids, and that would be your fats, and the proteins. Right? So essentially, there are four categories of molecules. So if we thought about all the molecules in you, we could divide them up into these four categories. Right? The lines now are getting pretty fuzzy as we get more and more information, but essentially there are four parts.
What were the four parts? Proteins, carbohydrates,
lipids, and the nucleic acids, the DNA and RNA. And what we say about these molecules in biochemistry is very interesting. Some of you may recognize this from other places. What we say about these molecules is that their structure relates to their function. Where does that come from besides just science?
Architecture.
Architecture. Form follows function. All right. We say the same thing in science. So there is a first example that we have that, again, you can see that human beings are bringing their experience into science. I mean, so who knows? Maybe as this first started in science, it was some architect was explaining to some biochemist about how form follows function and architecture, and the biochemist says, ah, same thing of molecules. All right. So. We see this kind of cross-germination from different fields. So that gives you right away two questions that you can ask about your molecules. The first question you can ask is, well, what are their structures? The second question you can ask is, what are their functions? And really, you have one more question from that. How does their structure relate to function? So without being a professionally trained biochemist, right away you have three things you can ask an expert about your molecules. Right? Which I think is useful. So since this project involves the DNA molecule, what I'd like to do is now spend a little bit of time talking about DNA structure, talking about DNA function. Unfortunately, we won't have time for me to show you how structure relates to function. So first of all, what we have to do is get into your cells and take your DNA out. So you might wonder how many cells you have. I had a student do a calculation for me this last semester, and he calculated that roughly a human organism, the average generic human organism, has 4 trillion cells. All right, so you might want to just think for a moment about your 4 trillion cells. All right, let's take one of those cells, and what we can do with some chemical means is we can bust open that cell, then we'd have to find the nucleus in that cell, because that's the part of the cell where you find your DNA. We'd bust open the nucleus, and then we could separate out your human DNA. All right? And what's interesting about your DNA is every single cell of those 4 trillion has the same, roughly the same piece of DNA. All right? So if you think about your brain cell, it's got a piece of DNA up there. You think down there about your big toe cell, it's also got that same piece of DNA in it. So every one of your 4 trillion cells has roughly the same DNA. Now, if we took your DNA and we stretched it out, we would find that human DNA is roughly 1 meter in length. It's roughly 1 meter in length. So here again, this is kind of an amazing thing. That how is it that a cell, which is very small, if we take the average liver cell, for example, the average liver cell has a diameter of about this many meters, right, which is very much smaller than 1 meter, 20 micrometers. So how is it that we take a meter of this molecule and put it into a cell that's got diameter of 20 micrometers? It's a pretty amazing thing, and we'll talk about it in just a
minute. Is that one of the smallest cells, liver cells?
No, it's actually one of the largest cells.
Oh.
All right, so right away that should give you some, and this is part of the joy of science. Wow, this is really incredible, right? Okay, let me tell you a little bit about the DNA before we try to stuff it into that cell. As you may or may not know, DNA, being a large molecule, is composed of smaller building blocks. And with the case of DNA, there are 4 kinds of building blocks. And again, these building blocks are also molecules. So you take building block molecules to build this long molecule. You can think of DNA then as a polymer, right? So like you have polyester that makes your clothing, your DNA is also a biopolymer composed of 4 building blocks. Well, now these building blocks are very tiny, so it turns out that each human DNA has roughly, the average human DNA, has roughly 3 billion building blocks. All right, so it takes 3 billion in some combination of these four to make your human DNA. Now, lest we think that we're something special because we have 3 billion building blocks, I'd like to remind you that there are other organisms which have more building blocks. So for example, the South American lungfish happens to have 120 billion building blocks in their DNA. So unless something is happening with those South American lungfishes that we don't know about, the amount of DNA you have doesn't put you anywhere on the evolutionary tree. I think we need to keep that in mind. All right, so now imagine a molecule. What's that?
How do you know that?
Yeah, good. Well, somebody obviously cares a great deal about South American lungfish. I have determined that. We could use this as a model for DNA, for example, or at least one part of DNA. I have how many different colors? I think I've got 5, actually. Pink, yellow, green, orange, purple. Pink yellow, green, orange, purple. There's too many colors here, but imagine that we had 4 colors, all right? And each one of these was a building block. It would take 3 billion of these to produce your human DNA, which would then result in a molecule a meter in length with a very, very thin diameter. Very, very, 4 nanometer diameter. Now, you all probably recognize the word DNA as genetic material. All right, how much of your genetic material is represented by this meter of DNA, or these 3 billion building blocks? It turns out that only 2 to 10% of that 3 billion building blocks is actually gene material. Right, and that's an important thing to keep in mind. Two to 10% of the DNA is genes. And it's theorized that there are roughly 50 to 100,000 genes which we require as humans to function. So that 50 to 100,000 genes is specified in the DNA, but only 2 to 10% of it. Let me just take a minute to go back to another structural question, and that is, how do we take this meter of DNA and put it into a cell? Some of you, when you think about DNA structure, when you think about James Watson and the title of his book, The Double Helix, that should tell you one level of DNA structure. So the first thing that happens with DNA is you take two of these and you line them up, and then you coil them in a helix. And what happens to the length when you do this? Right? So one of the strategies for cells is when they have very long molecules is to coil them. So again, there's something about structure and function there, that this molecule has got a function, we've got to get it into the cell, and one of the ways we do that is to coil it. But certainly that is not really the level of structure of DNA in your cells. So again, I think one conception we have about DNA is we've got these helices, these lovely helices floating around in our 4 trillion cells. And that's really not quite the whole picture. So now, how do we get this, what do we do with this coil? Well, let me show you the next level of structure with DNA. It's very clever how this has all been worked out. Imagine that these two tubes represent a helix, right? So they are coiled. What happens to the coiled material in a cell is the following. How would you describe what I'm doing here?
Twisting.
Yeah, twisting. And what happens, of course, in the end? Twist it, and what do you notice about the twisting process? What do you see me having to do here?
It's getting tighter.
It's getting tighter, it's getting harder for me to do. I have to put energy into this to do this. It's really a hard process. And if we close off now with a protein, this represents a protein molecule. All right, you can see that we've somehow now compacted the DNA even more. So now take your cell, put your double helix in there, twist it up tightly like a rubber band, and you have really the third level of DNA structure. Of course, that's not enough. We've got a meter that we've got to get into 20 micrometers. And so the next levels are probably what you're more familiar with. How many of you ever see a picture of a chromosome? All right. What you get a sense with that chromosome is it's really wound up really tightly, like almost like a skein of wool. So what happens next is this, we call this supercoiled DNA. This is coiled around proteins, and then those protein coils are coiled further, and you just keep coiling and coiling and coiling until you get the molecule into the cell. So that should give you some picture about your DNA. Do you have any questions or comments you'd like to put forth as you think about your DNA, as you sit there thinking about your DNA floating around in your nuclei?
Each individual DNA, Justin, it's a way of identifying a person. There's no two alike, or are these alike?
Half of your DNA comes from your mother and half comes from your father. But of course you get through evolution and through mutation, you get some changes happening. But your DNA would not be the same as my DNA.
Every time a cell divides, it has to completely uncoil.
It just uncoils in different regions. It uncoils a little bit at a time. And replicates. And that new piece then coils up as it's being made in the division process. Yeah?
If you go back to the Mendelian genetics, and are the genes paired to someone or another on the twist?
Right. One thing I didn't mention was we take that meter and we chop it into 23 pieces to get the chromosomes. So I think that's also part of the strategy of stuffing it all in. If you cut it into smaller pieces, you can push it in.
Yeah, in other words, you can pull it out. The word sequence then is just describing how.
Thank you.
Well, I was.
Yeah, I wanted to bring that up.
I've heard you so long, and I really didn't.
Yeah.
Really,
let me tell you what the word sequence means. I meant to do that. Thank you. Remember, we've got now this meter long of DNA with these 3 billion building blocks. To sequence means to determine the order of the different kinds of building blocks. So if I was to sequence this string here, I would sequence it as pink, yellow, pink, pink, green, orange, pink, purple, orange, yellow, pink, and so on. So what you do to sequence DNA is you determine the order of those four different kinds of building blocks. Thank you very much. Is that make it clear?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
Are you going to be telling us what the other 98% besides genes is?
I wish I could.
Well, if we get half of it from our mother and half of it from our father, why is it all not
useful?
Genes?
Yeah. It's a really good question. no one really knows the answer to that. Part of it is probably something like this. Remember, your brain cell has the same piece of DNA as your big toe cell does. So what that has to mean is that in your brain, there are genes operating that are not big toe genes. So you have to have this kind of regulation to turn on and off things. So certainly some of that 98% is involved in regulation, but not all of that 98%. And no one really knows at this point what the rest of it is doing. Uh-huh. There was a theory popular about 15 years ago or so that called the rest of this DNA garbage DNA. I don't know if you heard that thing, but yes. My DNA was offended by that. Again, you know, you see garbage, that's something coming in from the outside in the theory. All right, so you should have a little picture now of a DNA structure, all right? Let's move on to ask some questions about function, and that'll help us explain why one would want to sequence the human DNA. Well, let me just say a word about DNA function.
Does DNA act like a fingerprint? So you could, you had a little piece of it, you could decide who that person was?
Yes, and in fact, you know, they use that now in forensics. Of course, there's some controversy about the usefulness of that in forensics, but some people are using it. So it depends on who your lawyer is, I guess, whether or not it's accepted.
I think I read they were using that in the Army now instead of identification tag.
Oh,
they were
really?
Just going to have a little bank of DNA.
Uh-huh. The controversy in the forensic field is you've got to figure out statistically if it's possible for one human being to have the same DNA. You wouldn't want to accuse the wrong person. And so some people argue that there is a possibility. Yeah.
Just to give you an example of a big controversy in Canada that's been going on in the last few months is that there's a fellow who was thrown in jail for 15 years for raping and murdering a woman, and he claims that he's been innocent. Anyway, they, because of the rape research and so on, they are taking the sample of his semen on the clothes of the woman who was killed 15 years ago, and they are investigating.
Uh-huh. So they hope to use the DNA test as the,
that's right,
the proof.
That's right.
Yeah, it is still a little bit controversial, but sometimes they're able to get it to hold up in court, and other times they're not. Let me show you now a little bit about DNA function. And it's described in what's called the central dogma of molecular biology. All right, so what I'm going to present to you is what's called the central dogma of molecular biology. Right? Again, remember now, human beings create these theory systems. What the central dogma says is the DNA specifies the synthesis of another molecule called RNA, and then that RNA is used to specify the synthesis of proteins. And proteins are often described as the workhorses of the cell. So these are the workhorses here. Or I like to describe them as the housewives of the cell. There's my interpretation. Uh-huh. So you can see then that if proteins are used to carry out cell function, DNA has a very important role in just the normal operation of cells. And that might not be something that you may realize, because often you think about DNA as being involved in that heredity function. So DNA specifies the synthesis of itself so that it can be passed down through different generations. So DNA has two functions, a heredity function and a very important cell function. Right? Now with that central dogma then, the way it's stated, you can see why you would want to spend $3 billion at 15 years and human resource, scientific human resource, in sequencing DNA, right? DNA is often described as the master molecule. So if we were to take this for a moment and read this like a painting, what does this theory about DNA function tell us about the culture out of which the people who created this theory are coming from?
They were farmers.
They were farmers, all right? Because we got workhorses involved. What else does the theory, how else can we read the theory to understand culture?
Well, we'd certainly like to fragment everything.
Okay, so there's DNA with its separate function, RNA, are you thinking in that way?
Kind of a sense of hierarchy.
A sense of hierarchy. DNA is in control here. All right?
Yeah. Mastery.
All right? Mastery.
It can master the cells and we can master it.
Exactly. Exactly. Exactly.
The peck and pole.
What's that?
The peck and pole.
The peck and pole. Exactly. Exactly. All right? And perhaps another part of it too. It's kind of a recipe for function, so we're talking about a very mechanized view of how cells work. So we see this whole idea of mechanization, which of course is very characteristic of the scientific revolution and what science does for us, mechanization. All right, I would like to offer you another interpretation of DNA function. And it's not only my interpretation, there are other people who have brought this notion forth, that there is another way to interpret how DNA functions. But you can see that if you're trying to justify $3 billion to sequence the human DNA, this dogma works really well, because it says DNA is the master molecule, it's the thing that we care about. So if we understand DNA, then we understand, well, in fact, one of the main forces behind this project, Walter Gilbert, who's a Nobel Prize winning chemist from Harvard University, says that if we know DNA, if we know the structure of DNA, I have to get the quote straight, direct. The direct quote is, to know your DNA is to know yourself. All right, so not only do we have this central dogma, but I think we also have something else behind that statement. To know your DNA is to know yourself. Now, on first glance, you might be thinking, huh, sounds good, right? To know your DNA is to know yourself. But I think if you think about it a little further, what I wonder is if Walter Gilbert went to a liberal arts college, is what I wonder. Because I think what he's saying here is that science can tell us everything. And if you look how science is situated in society at this point in our history, it seems as if we asked science to solve all problems. Here we are now asking science to solve the problem of homelessness. Right? To know your DNA is to know yourself. So it's pretty hard to argue with this, right? How are we going to do this? Well, the first thing that I think we can say is, this statement is almost acceptable to me if we just say, to know your DNA is to know yourself as a biological organism. So if I'm thinking about myself in the natural world, if I'm thinking about my friends, the deer or the rocks don't have DNA, but the bugs that are on the rocks have DNA. If I want to challenge the statement, I think the first place to challenge it is to remember that we are biological organisms too, and knowing our DNA really tells us about our biological organism. I think that's the first place we can challenge this. The second place we can challenge this is in another interpretation for DNA function. So let me show you another interpretation here for DNA function that's floating around. We haven't made the textbooks yet, but I expect in another 10 years or so, we'll start appearing in the textbooks. This other interpretation for DNA function says the DNA specifies the synthesis of RNA. RNA makes proteins. And guess what? DNA can't do any of its own function without proteins.
Without what?
Without proteins. Where that central dogma had it all going in one direction. What this says is that DNA works in collaboration with proteins in order to carry out cell function.
It's a chicken and the egg thing.
It is a chicken and the egg. It is a chicken and the egg thing. And no one has answered that question of which came first, the DNA or the protein. But you can see that with an interpretation like this now, you're going to do your science differently. Yeah.
It's interesting because that sort of raises to mind the wave particle question in physics, in that you can look at this model in two different ways. That you can jump in at one part and start with DNA, which means that the way you conceive of this, your approach is going to be different. Or you can look at the whole and then you'll see it differently as well. So, but both are true.
Exactly. You can say that DNA has the blueprint for the cell, which would be a true statement. But you also have to say that proteins are required in order to make DNA function.
You know, and part of the thing of the way in our society, the way we fragment everything, does an injustice to seeing the whole, because if you got it all torn up, how do you see it?
Yep, and I think that's one traditional strategy in science, is to reduce to different parts. And believe it or not, there are a lot of things that we can't answer about in science still. I mean, there are lots of things about the natural world for which we have no explanations. And I would posit that part of the reason we don't is because we are looking at a very fragmented way. We don't understand really well how collections of molecules come together to create certain kinds of functions. So yeah. Yeah.
And the central dogma being linear like that, what happens to protein? Does it fall off the face of the earth then, or what?
Yeah, that eventually they wear out and you have to replace them. I mean, what does happen normally is there is protein turnover.
But DNA is
the boss.
The nuclear reactor that generates
exactly.
The stuff and itself perpetuating.
According to that dogma. You know, that dogma doesn't say anything about how DNA works. Which is generally, isn't that generally true of leaders as well? You always know that behind a good leader is an army of people who are...
But that's the accepted theory now?
The central dogma?
Yeah.
Oh, definitely. Definitely.
They've come to... Do they ignore? Or is that just the...
Well, I suppose their rationale is, again, if you could figure out the sequence of the DNA, then you could figure out how the, you could figure out what the proteins are, and then you could start working on how the proteins function. But even then, remember what we're going to do, essentially, is we're going to go to this massive volume of books. It's like something like 200 sets of the Encyclopedia Britannica adds up to the information in DNA molecules. And then we've got to read all this. We've got to find that 2 to 10% that works. And then, even if we can read it, we still really don't understand fully how DNA turns into proteins. So we're even further away. We think we're close to figuring out DNA, but having that central dogma approach, we're even further away from figuring out how proteins work. Much to the chagrin of many protein chemists at this point in time. Yeah. Other comments? All right, so I think you can see my point about if we remember that knowledge is constructed by people, there are other ways to interpret things, and maybe we shouldn't posit things like dogma as truth. Because if we do that, then we fall into the trap of, you know, wanting our tax dollars to go to support sequencing, reading 200 volumes of the Encyclopedia Britannica.
That reminds me of the quote that Bateson used, the map is not the territory.
The map is not the territory.
That's good. We get fooled to believe the map is the territory.
That's good. So, you know, I think we really have to be careful because it's so easy to say to a scientist, oh yeah, that theory must be right. You know, that must be the truth. How can we argue? Right? Well, the very first point we can argue on is, you know, is there another interpretation? Should we be looking at this another way? Yeah?
It's my understanding they're using a lot of the computer software for doing this research. So that bias then is probably already built into the computer software as well that's doing the analyzing.
Yeah. Imagine collecting all this information. How you collect the information is you have to get overlaps. What you do is you take this DNA and you divide it in pieces one time, and then you sequence these pieces, and then what you do is, you know, you figure out the order. Then what you do is you get another piece of DNA, a little more energy into that bond. You get another piece of DNA, and you clip it another way. So you take the sequence of this, and then ultimately you figure out the whole sequence by overlapping. So it's going to take huge, massive computer support to do this.
Well, that must mean then that a particular construction of reality, that there's going to be a lot of value put into a particular construction over another work. In other words, for the last 15 years, the linear model has been the one that's reigning, and lots and lots of money has been going into generating data arising from that model.
Right. Right.
That even if that's a better model, it may not. That one may not fly. I mean, that one may never get off the ground.
This particular one, yeah, because of the huge investment that we have at this point. Absolutely, absolutely, huge investment. And let me just say one more word about the computer investment. Computer people are not so interested in this problem. That it's been really hard for the genome people to get computer people interested, because it really isn't that exciting a problem to computer scientists. And so there hasn't been a whole lot of support from the computer world.
Well, I'd like to pursue that question.
Sure.
Are you saying there's bias in this? There are errors in the use of software. So we've got almost double errors here. We can't really describe in the very, very finite how this computer cranks out. It takes care of airline reservations. It does all these things, but it gets down to the very small, and it can't be explained. So then you're trying to explain another one with that one. Is that it?
Well, I'm just if you have one sense of reality in your programmed computer, you build that into your program.
Yeah.
And so that bias exists in that software in whatever you do. I mean, that's, you're just explaining reality in some way as well. In that software.
Okay, well, I was reading something else that because it seems to me I heard the computer people talk about this once. I walked out of the room, saying, hey, they can't explain this in the final thing either.
Uh-huh.
You know, I mean, you can make them work, but it doesn't, it's like getting down to the very finest part here. Uh-huh. Just to feel, you know, the charges or whatever.
Right.
Oh, yeah. It gets me things reversing and all kinds of crazy things. Yeah. It isn't just a plus minus deal.
Yeah. I think at this point, the computer is just a tool, I think.
Yeah, it is a tool.
Which is not understood very well. Plus, also the use of the tool. You always have human error when you use tool. Yeah. And I should say, I was talking to one of the people on staff here who was in graduate school most recently in molecular biology, who reminded me that the operation of sequencing itself is not fully perfect. That there are many cases when you do sequencing that you really can't tell if it's orange or pink. And so there still is quite a lot of quite a number of problems with the technique itself. Yeah. Plus, it's very labor intensive, and it is the most boring thing you could ever want to do as a scientist. So what we're going to be doing until we get machines to do this, Leroy Hood at Caltech has a machine, and the Japanese have a machine to do this sequencing.
What's the machine called?
It's a DNA sequencer. But until we get affordable DNA sequencers, we're using human resources, we're using people to do this work. So we're asking the best and brightest that we have in science, and we don't have that many anymore, to carry out this rather mundane, very boring, often ambiguous sequencing work. It's very interesting. Do I think it's going to be done? Well, I don't know. I mean, I guess I believe in people, yeah.
Let me ask another question.
Yeah.
Ought it to be done?
Ought it to be done.
In other words, it seems like a very interesting thing. And, of course, it has potential, perhaps, effects good or bad for our society, but it's extraordinarily expensive. And if it's the case that a particular model is going to generate a certain kind of data, which may be misleading, and it costs a lot of money to do that, should it be done at all?
Certainly within the scientific community itself, there is a lot of controversy about the project. But apparently, I was reading the story about some of this controversy in a popular journal, actually, a popular magazine, about the controversy. And what's happened is the most vocal critics have been given a small piece of this $3 billion pie. All right. Many people were saying, well, we really want to work on our protein projects. You know, it's going to really be able to help you all in the end. So, you know, you're getting all the money. What about us? So James Watson figured out, we'll just give some of those people a little piece of the pie. And apparently that's really helped some of the controversy among the scientific community to die down. Although I still think there are a number of people, even on scientific grounds alone, not on this resource allocation method alone, think on scientific grounds that it's not the way we ought to be allocating our resources. Do I think it's going to be done? I still haven't answered. Or what was you had a
question? I asked whether it ought to be done.
Whether it ought to be done. Yeah. Yeah. Well, I would really like to see the day happen in our society where sometime the society says to the scientific enterprise, we don't want you to work on this right now. You know, I'm not going to argue that it shouldn't be done ever, but maybe we ought to think about whether now is the time. Yeah.
You mentioned the Japanese hand machine, and I'm assuming the other guy was American?
American, yeah.
Is this an international project?
This is purportedly an international project. HUGO is the acronym for the international project. I can't remember all the human, I don't know. I can't remember all the parts. But what's happening is, of course, America is putting forth the most amount of money to this project. The Japanese have only contributed a small amount. In fact, they were hanging on to their money and not wanting to participate in the project. And James Watson said to the Japanese, if you don't participate, we're not going to sell your cars or something like that. I mean, he really lit the fire. He really insulted the Japanese a great deal, apparently, in his move to threaten them.
Is it all being done here or under the auspices of American project?
Well, there are small labs in other countries that are contributing small amounts of work, but primarily it's being done here in the United States.
So there's not a big enough, the Soviet Union is still viable.
Yeah.
There's not a big enough group out there that, well, we don't like your linear, we like this.
Right.
And being just, working on their own field.
The problem with our science is it's Western science that's permeated throughout the world. And in fact, you know, we talk about making sure we use the same kind of units so that we can talk the same language. So there's this push to homogenize throughout the world.
Is the point of doing all this research ultimately, you mentioned in the beginning, a cure for Parkinson's and a cure for cancer, and through this DNA, figuring that if they understand it enough and manipulate it, that they can cure diseases?
Yeah, in fact, tomorrow's subject is the case of cystic fibrosis, which is a genetic disorder among, very interestingly, white Americans, where they're working fast and furiously on a gene cure for this. But I think they say that, I think that's the first rationale. I mean, I think that's the superficial rationale. And I think we need to explore as we move through the week.
That's what gets us to spend the money.
Exactly. Don't we want to solve this problem?
Well, yeah, and if you call it into question, then it's you don't want to. You serve our barbaric.
And that poor little child who's suffering from this disorder.
But the superficial is the what they're telling us. Maybe I'm just too cynical, but let's split the atoms where you can have boundless energy. No, let's split the atoms where you can blow up a whole bunch of people and hurt ourselves.
Yeah. Let me just say, following along my idea about, wouldn't it be fine if at this point in our history, the United States citizens said, you know, citizens in Germany, I guess when it was West Germany, so how long ago was that? 3 years ago or so? Said to their scientific arm of the government, we don't want to work on this project right now. And they, for a time, they were able to halt the research. I don't know what the current status is, but for a time, they were able to do that. I mean, just imagine what it would do to our sense of power as citizens if we could say, if we could do this. We could say, let's stop for the moment. Yeah.
And who's what agency in Washington or department is administering the $3 billion?
It's very interesting. Two agencies, the National Institutes of Health, which you would expect, but also the Department of Energy is the other agency doling out money. And their rationale is they've been following for years now the genetics of the Japanese people who were bombed in Hiroshima and other places, because they want to see, you know, their human subjects for the Department of Energy. They're interested in seeing the long-term effects. And so their rationale was, we need to get into this project so that we can continue that study. And so that's how the Department of Energy got initially. Now, I should say in the government's defense that of that $3 billion, they have slotted 3% of that $1 billion to study the ethical, social, and legal implications. Of the use of human genetic information. All right, so in their defense, out of the $3 billion, 3% is going to ethical, social, legal implications study. So what that means is you submit a grant to the NIH, and they read your grant and decide whether or not you get their money. So again, there's that layer of, it's not everybody who's going to be able to get a piece of this 3% pie. And I should say that I'm involved in a project with a woman from Boston. We've put in a grant to this organization, because we'd like to have a conference of women coming together talking about what this is going to mean for women.
Did you get funded?
I don't know. I won't know until October. Okay. I'm very interested to know whether or not the NIH will fund this. Because as you know, there's been some controversy about how much attention the NIH pays to women.
How does this project compare in cost with, particle accelerator
in Texas? Yeah, let me see. I think I have those. I actually happen to have those figures right here. I had them for earlier in the week. Let me find them here.
It sounds like some of the same political things going on there.
Exactly.
Japan was also told that they better give the up for this project.
Exactly.
Well.
Exactly. Let me see. Here it is. Super Collider is getting $650 million this year. And this project is getting $108 million this year. So, you know, in fairness, $3 billion is really not that much money, but again, it's money that we could be spending other places. Just to give you some examples, NASA is getting $8 billion this year. This was Bush proposed that NASA would get $8 billion this year alone for R&D. You know, so admittedly, it's not a huge piece of the pie, but the potential consequences, I think, are huge. Yeah.
There are private contributors in this project?
No. There's very little research done in this country that is comes from private money. Is that, would you agree with that?
Well, although if you get into genetic engineering, I think you get...
You're starting to see more and more.
You talked about that the other day on this today, didn't you?
No, I don't think I did.
I'm talking about, shifting some stuff and that's going to change a plant.
No, I didn't talk about
herbicide that. Herbicide resistance and all this. Oh, there's a lot of money going in.
More and more companies are getting into it because it's
like
going to be.
Monsanto went, not in partnership, but with Harvard, I believe, and
right.
MIT, one of the
right.
other ones.
So now you get into all kinds of other problems, because if the company is paying money to do the research, they're not going to want to share the information that you have.
Well, they're seeing the product that way. Right?
Yeah,
I
absolutely.
No question about that. That's where some of these questions come in.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You had a comment?
Indeed, yeah. Isn't it in the Supreme Court state that you could patent new organisms?
And in fact, there's a very recent controversy with that, because the NIH now, the government, has taken out a patent on some of this DNA sequencing information.
Yeah.
And now Japan is all hot and other,
And states are going, ruling on this business too.
They took out a patent on what?
DNA information, just the sequencing information. Let me just close by reading a paragraph from Popular Mechanics has a story on the Genome Project, biology's biggest gamble in Popular Mechanics. It's interesting. This is May 1991. Yeah, I just happened to be reading Popular Mechanics. Let's see. The NIH, which has the largest genome budget, has pledged to spend 3% of it in the coming fiscal year on research into the ethical dimension of the genome. Certainly, the issues are knotty. But proponents of the project respond that abuses can be avoided in the same way as with currently available medical tests. Right? If ethical safeguards can be established, the odds are good that the human genome will be not only one of the most powerful medical tools ever developed, but among the most beneficial. So this is Popular Mechanics. So, we've really got a big project ahead of us if we want to make even a tiny little dent. I mean, we really have got to start asking questions about this. And I think today we've begun to do that. Any other questions or comments? We've got 3 more minutes on the tape, so if you'd like to chime in with a question or comment.
When are we going to discuss those kinds of questions that we briefly touched on at the breakfast table this morning? Shouldn't we be spending the money on helping people right now, in their social problems.
Right.
And focusing our ethical questions on, how we treat people in the society rather than this. I mean, we are
going to get to those. Tomorrow I want to give you an example in detail about what people are thinking of with the cystic fibrosis case. Then Thursday, my title is Designer Genes, Fad or Fashion. I thought that would be the place where we could look at ethical, social, legal implications. And then Friday, I think we can spend some time looking at how church bodies are responding. 2 church bodies, the Presbyterians and the Methodists, have come up with a statement on genetic engineering. And the Lutherans, as far as I know, do not have a statement yet.
What have they said?
I can't remember, and I will know by Friday. An honest scientist there, I'm being honest with you. A human, I'm being human. So that's the goal, that maybe on Friday we can actually do some strategizing about. And then I can take what you tell me to a particular group that I'm working with. So thank you for your participation. Think genes throughout the day. Throughout the week.
Designer genes.
Designer genes, right.